Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Educators face a big challenge this summer, combating summer learning loss and making up for lingering issues created by teaching kids remotely this spring.
If the students didn't learn much from March through June, and then you factor in summer learning loss and figure that, you know, this may be broader than usual this summer, students could very well be as much as 6 months behind where they ought to be.
Contributor Larry Nagengast examines learning initiatives, old and new, that will be at work this summer. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our arts playlist tells us about the effort to get concerts going again in Wilmington at a recognizable outdoor venue. And we bring you the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A Matter of Facts. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, we took a look back at how remote learning efforts across the state fared while schools were shut down by the COVID-19 pandemic this spring. This week, we look ahead to the challenge this summer holds for educators. They're not only tasked with combating the usual summer learning loss, but now need to address learning progress stunted by the pandemic, the so-called COVID slide. Contributor Larry Nagengast took a closer look at some of the learning initiatives in the First State attempting to meet these challenges in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss what he found. So based on all the reporting you've done this spring, including into remote learning efforts in First State schools and such, how much does the COVID slide exacerbate the issues of summer learning loss that we usually see this time of year?
Well, that's a good question, and it's really not a very easy one to answer. The Delaware educators that I've been speaking with over the last couple of months have suggested everything from students making no progress at all from March through the end of the school year, up to students learning just as much online as they would have in a regular classroom. But that range that they've offered me doesn't take into account the unknown number of students who are essentially off the grid for 3 months. Either they lack internet connections or for one reason or another didn't care enough about what they should have been learning to log on. And, you know, there could be any number of other factors. Now, you may ask about summer learning loss as well, and this primarily affects low-income children who are less likely to have the resources to pursue academic interests in the summer. You know, they don't go to, the summer camps, the space camps, things like that, kids from, middle-class, upper-middle-class backgrounds have the opportunity to enjoy during the summer. So anyhow, research suggests that these students may lose as much as 3 months or so of development in reading or math over the summer. So taking those things into consideration, let me try to give you a little bit of layman's math here. You know, if the students didn't learn much from March through June, and then you factor in summer learning loss and figure that, you know, this may be broader than usual this summer, students could very well be as much as 6 months behind where they ought to be by the time classes resume in September. Now, that's quite a bit of catch-up work that teachers are going to have to do in the fall before they can start moving their students ahead into what would ordinarily be next year's lessons.
Now, your piece highlights one program specifically trying to address this issue. It's called WAVE. How is it similar? How is it different from learning initiatives we've seen previously?
Well, WAVE is a collaborative effort. It's aimed at middle school and high school students, and it was developed by leaders at the Community Education Building in Wilmington, the Great Oaks Charter School, which is one of the building's tenants, and several education-oriented nonprofits. Foundations and organizations like United Way are funding the project. Now, this isn't your typical summer school. It's not makeup classes for kids who did poorly from September to June. Rather, the 200 or so teens who are going to be participating in the program will choose classes that are designed to capture their interest. They have topics like aviation, money, entrepreneurship, dance, yoga, computer coding, creative writing. The partnerships that make WAVE work are very much like those that have made the Summer Learning Collaborative a successful program for kids in the elementary grades over the last 6 years. And these class concepts tapping into topics that teenagers feel passionate about and the individualized attention that participants will receive, all of that parallels the approach taken by Dual School, which is an innovative project-based learning program that was launched 3 years ago in the Wilmington area.
Now, this is going to be an online endeavor, at least to start. So how does it avoid some of the issues we saw with remote learning during the school year?
Well, I mentioned that Great Oaks Charter School is a partner in the WAVE venture. And one of the unique things about Great Oaks is that they have a special team of staff members that supplements classroom learning with one-on-one and small group instruction in math and language arts. Now, that concept is being incorporated into WAVE, where many of these Great Oaks teachers are going to be spending their summer, and they'll be serving as guides, working with groups of eight teenagers at a time. What they'll do is they'll hold that, and all this is online virtual meetings. They'll hold morning meetings and afternoon debriefings with their little group each day. They'll remind the participants to log on to their online classes. They'll make sure that they're participating in these classes, and they're generally serving as mentors. You know, they'll be available for phone and Zoom conversations during the day. Now, we know that one of the issues that schools had during the spring was that they did lose contact with some of their students. This personal mentoring and guidance is meant to counteract that problem.
Now, this program also emphasizes planning for college and career. What does that piece look like?
Well, now again, it's generally recognized that children in low-income families don't always have friends and relatives who can guide them towards college or provide strong career advice. Many of the kids in this situation are going to be the first generation in their families to go on to college if they so desire. And we also know that public school counselors have to work with so many students that they can't give all of them the attention that they would like and need. WAVE is going to try to give its participants some college and career advice by scheduling a series of online conversations with recent college graduates. And many of these recent grads are friends and former classmates of these young men and women who are working as WAVE guides this summer. These recent graduates, recent college grads, people who are just starting their careers, the messages that they can provide to these high school and middle school students may very well have a greater impact on these teenagers than the 1 or 2 10-minute meetings that these students might have during the year with their regular guidance counselors.
So is there some hope that this could help improve distance learning efforts in schools during the school year, that some of this will translate?
Well, you know, there are hopes, but, you know, being realistic, you know, let's not expect changes during the upcoming school year. For September, it's just going to be a big enough challenge to get the schools up and running in what looks to be a very uncertain environment. And also, I don't think that the hopes here are confined to just the distance learning mode. I mean, you know, one of the key points made by the innovators behind programs like WAVE and Dual School is that kids are more motivated to learn when they're working on topics that interest them. And they're also saying that, you know, the traditional butts in the seat method, you know, students trying to absorb information while sitting in a classroom, or as it was this spring, watching a Zoom session in front of a computer, that really doesn't work and play very well for today's generation of teenagers. So now, where does that lead? I'm not quite sure, but I mean, let's face it, the broad outline of the high school curriculum requirements really haven't changed that much since I was a high school freshman, and that was 60 years ago. Now, but what I do see, especially when you factor in that the pandemic is likely to lead to smaller class sizes and fewer hours spent within school buildings, is a different sort of blend of learning modes. So you take some of those classroom lessons and you replace them with two different components, some online instructional modules and some independent study, with the teacher serving as more of a learning guide, kind of an educational Sherpa, if you will, than the traditional stand and deliver lecturer type. The key here in education, as in so many aspects of society, is to acknowledge that right now, I believe we're really at a true inflection point. Going back to where we were pre-pandemic is hardly a sign of progress. And quite frankly, there aren't too many people right now who are praising the status quo in Delaware education either. So the time is ripe for trying something new. And what takes hold in the future could very well be some of the ideas that are being incubated these days in pilot projects like WAVE and like the dual school.
You mentioned dual school. You also mentioned earlier the summer collaborative. You've previously reported on those. How are they doing and how are they operating this summer?
Well, again, both of those programs will be running this summer, but the shift to distance learning is prompting some changes. Summer Collaborative will again be offering its kindergarten through fifth grade program through community centers and through Boys and Girls Clubs up and down the state, everywhere from Claymont down into Sussex County. Now, Collab develops project-based learning experiences that deliver education while promoting a fun environment in a summer camp setting. However, the reading literacy component of the project, and this is essentially a half hour of one-on-one or small group instruction, is going to be offered virtually this year. And that means that anyone, even kids who aren't affiliated with a Boys and Girls Club, can sign up. And I've got a link in my story for details on that and how to register for it. Now, Collab is also running Tyler's Camp, which is an educational program geared more for middle school students at locations in the Colonial School District. Now, as for the dual school, they're offering 4 one-week sessions with weekly themes like social justice, the environment, health and wellness, and technology. The groups will have 2 one-hour online meetings, one on Monday and one on Thursday, and the participants can use the time in between to work on their own projects related to that weekly theme. It's not like you're going to be able to complete a whole project the way they do in 12 weeks in dual school, but at least it's kind of a tease to learn a little bit about design thinking and the process involved in building your creativity. Again, registration links for those projects are also in my story. Now, one other thing that's very important, both of these programs, Summer Collab and Dual School, are funded by nonprofits and businesses, so there's no charge at all to the people who participate in them.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. You can read his reporting on summer learning initiatives in the First State at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Arts Playlist tells us more about a drive-in concert experience coming to Wilmington next month. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Another concert series was recently canceled by the coronavirus pandemic. Wilmington's Summer Concert Series, hosted by the Riverfront Development Corporation, is normally held Thursday nights in July and August. But while that series won't happen this year, the Riverfront Development Corporation and The Grand are trying something new next month, a drive-in concert series at Frawley Stadium. On this week's Arts Playlist, our Kelly Steele chats with the Riverfront Development Corporation's marketing manager, Joe Valenti, and the Grand's executive director, Mark Fields, about navigating the coronavirus pandemic, starting with Valenti discussing canceling the summer concert series.
With all of the restrictions from the state's reopening plan, while the concert would have been in July and August and would have been outdoor, so we would have been able to put something on and in a limited capacity, we really made the decision just based on just what our priority is, the health and safety of our guests, and thought that the safest option would have been to cancel for this upcoming year, for the 2020 season. And then, we look to begin that again in 2021.
Joe, give me some background about the summer concert series.
Sure. It's been over 20 years. It's been a staple on the riverfront, both at our Drevo Plaza, where it currently is, and then for a few years at our Riverfront Park. Right along the Riverwalk. It's traditionally it's every Thursday evening in July and August. So either 8 or 9 concert events, depending on the calendar year. And we bring in a variety of different acts, each week being a different genre of music, a different type of music, all local bands and all that have sort of a pretty large local following. So we would get a really, really diverse crowd, but always a, an energetic local crowd that was invested in the acts performing.
How much, Joe, is this causing a financial impact, canceling this series? What kind of financial impact is it having on the Riverfront Development Corporation?
I would say more a secondary impact on the businesses around us. The concert itself was free for everyone, so we didn't generate a direct amount of revenue from the actual shows themselves, but there would be several hundred, all up to about 1,000 for some shows, visitors down on the riverfront who, after either before or after the concert, would visit the restaurants, bars, shops, local activities, our miniature golf course, our river taxi. So I think all of those attractions are really feeling the financial crunch from this, just as they really as they have been during the this entire pandemic.
With all the bad news that we've been talking with Joe Valenti about, there is some really good news. The Riverfront Development Corporation is partnering with the Grand to offer a drive-in concert series starting in July at Frawley Stadium. And on the line to talk to me about that, we have Mark Fields, the executive director of the Grand. Sir, welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, how did this idea come about?
Well, Kelly, we've been pretty frustrated for the last 3 months because what we do is put on shows and host artists and entertain the community, and we haven't been able to do that. We closed down on the 12th of March, just hours before one of our Broadway shows was supposed to start its run, and have had to cancel more than 50 performances this spring. And it's very hard to do that for a performing arts organization, not just for the practical reasons, but also for the kind of emotional reasons. We're in this for a reason, and what we do is we put on shows. And so we've been trying to figure out, as we've worked our way through this pandemic, if there were ways that we could still put on shows, even though we can't really open our theaters yet. And we saw some examples in Europe of people who tried drive-in concerts, and we thought, well, that might be an idea that we could do here. And so we talked to a lot of folks. The county, Newcastle County, is involved in this. The city of Wilmington is involved in this. We've gotten PNC Bank to come on board as a sponsor. And as you mentioned, we're also working with RDC and the Stadium Corporation at the Riverfront to launch this series in July right in front of Frawley Stadium.
Before we mention the concert lineup, talk about the financial impact, if you will, Mark, that COVID has had on the Grand and on the theater district in general.
Well, in a word, it's been devastating. We've lost revenue in really three different ways, because as soon as we had to close down, our primary source of revenue, selling tickets, ended. But we also lost a whole set of rentals in the building as well, not just to our resident companies, we have 5 of those, but also community rentals, outside promoter rentals. And then the third way that we lost income was contributions, because when there isn't a reason to excite people about what we're doing, they don't think of us to make contributions. So this was really a triple whammy for us, and we're talking about millions of dollars of loss. But beyond the Grand itself, as you intimated, we bring 200,000 people a year to downtown Wilmington, and those people aren't coming anymore. And so that has had an effect on, the restaurants had to close because of the virus, but even as they are starting to reopen now, one of the normal streams of patrons for those restaurants and other retail establishments are the performances at the Grand and the Playhouse and the Baby Grand. And those aren't happening now and are not likely to happen very soon.
Mark, in your recent memory, can you remember anything like this happening in the past?
No, nothing like this has happened in my living memory and in the living memory of most of our patrons and supporters. The Grand was open back in the early 1900s when the Spanish flu situation happened. We actually don't have very good records from that period of time to research what the impact was then. But as far as the modern history of the Grand, since it was renovated in the 70s, there's nothing that's happened like this and hasn't happened for most people that are on the planet now.
All right. I started off this conversation with Mark Fields. Mark is the executive director of the Grand in Wilmington. Started off the conversation by announcing that Mark and the Grand are partnering with the Riverfront Development Corporation to offer a drive-in concert series in the Frawley Stadium parking lot during the month of July. Now, you told me this is going to be rolling announcements because you're not sure quite yet how it's going to work, although I'm almost certain it's going to be fantastic. Who's the first concert?
Our first concert is going to be Friday, July the 3rd, and it'll be one of the resident companies of the Grand Opera House, the Rock Orchestra, which is a local rock band that performs classic rock music very faithfully to the original recordings. And they're going to do a Greatest Hits of the Beatles concert on July the 3rd.
I was going to say, that's going to be fantastic. July 4th weekend. Are you expecting a huge crowd?
We certainly hope so. We think that there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand for entertainment. People have had to entertain themselves at home with their TVs and their laptops for a long time, and although, you know, that's fine, it doesn't replicate the experience of live performance. And so we sincerely believe and we hope that people will be able to come out. One of the advantages we have, Kelly, in doing this as a drive-in series is that people will come in and they can either stay in their cars and listen to the concert while they're watching it, listen to it over their FM radio. We're going to broadcast the concert signal, or they'll be able to get out and sit in lawn chairs in the space next to their car. We're going to space the cars so that we're maintaining social distancing. We're going to ask people to stay in their own space so that they can remain safe and still have an enjoyable outdoor experience.
Now, what will the exact location of the Rock Orchestra be? Where will they be?
Well, the Newcastle County is one of our partners on this project as well, and they are providing what they call their showmobile, their portable stage, which can be brought in on a trailer, in essence. And we're going to set that up in the parking lot and then orient all the cars toward that stage.
Oh, okay.
And our hope is that we'll be able to frame this so that the beautiful exterior of Frawley Stadium is in the background.
So with the social distancing of the vehicles themselves that are coming in for the concert, about how many vehicles can you fit at Frawley Stadium in the parking lot?
Well, this is one of those things that we're going to have to see if it works out in practice the way we've calculated it in theory. We think we can get somewhere between 175 and 200 cars. And assuming that there's somewhere between 2 and 4 people in every car, that means, you know, somewhere between 300 and 500 people will be able to come to this concert. And as you mentioned before, if we have success with this launch on the 3rd of July, then it's our plan to continue to present these throughout the summer and maybe even into the fall, and not necessarily just at the Riverfront. We're going to start at the Riverfront in July. But part of our idea is to move this around a little bit. We're looking for locations in southern Newcastle County for August and then north of Wilmington for September.
Where can people get more information about the first concert and just more information about what's happening at Frawley Stadium in general?
Well, for this particular series that we're doing, then the Grand, we're calling this Concerts by Car. You can go to the Grand website, which is thegrandwilmington.org, and we'll have information there. All of the sales for this are in advance. We're not going to do any walk-ups so that we can maintain contactless point of sale. So it's really important that people plan ahead and buy their tickets in advance. And we're working on a plan that will have a rain date for these concerts so that if it doesn't, if the weather's really inclement on the day that we originally planned, later in the weekend, we'll pick the concert up again.
Mark, this is fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing who else is coming for this drive-in concert series. This is going to be fantastic.
Well, we're very hopeful that it will work. We're very hopeful that this is something that will meet a need in the community. And part of the idea, Kelly, is that we also wanted to help some of our fellow arts organizations that have, you know, are in a similar situation to us. They just haven't been able to perform. And so this has been some pretty intricate planning because the artists themselves have to be able to socially distance on stage so that they can stay safe. But we hope to have a variety of local performers that will be engaged throughout the summer. And there's even a possibility as this idea develops that we might be able to attract some regional or even national acts to be a part of the mix. We know that there are a lot of artists who are out there who are as itching to perform as we are to present them. And we've been having conversations with some agents, and it's possible that some of them will, just for the love of performing and for supporting this idea, may join our lineup.
Thanks to Riverfront Development Corporation Marketing Manager Joe Valente and the Grand's Executive Director Mark Fields for joining our Kelly Steele on Arts Playlist. And The Green continues next with the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. Stay with us for that. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of the Delaware Humanities mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast is more closely examining popular sources of news and information. And this episode is focused on Facebook, with University of Delaware Associate Communications Professor Lindsay Hoffman. She is also Associate Director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and her work emphasizes both the social and psychological influences on individual media use and effects, including messages that encourage or discourage participation in political activities. Here is the latest A Matter of Facts podcast. It has been edited for time. Dr. Hoffman, we appreciate you taking time to be with us on the A Matter of Facts podcast. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be with you.
So as we look at the social media landscape, is there something that specifically drew you to Facebook as a platform to study specifically about political involvement and how people interact in that part of it?
Well, that's sort of where I started my social science research on social media. But of course, the social media world has exploded since then. So one of the first studies I did looking at social media was, particularly in terms of news and political engagement, did look at Facebook because that was the primary platform at the time. So I believe the study was conducted in 2011. It was published in 2012. And it's titled, cleverly, All the News That's Fit to Post, A Profile of News Use on Social Networking Sites. So back in 2011, 2012, Facebook was kind of the dominant social media platform to begin with, but we also saw news organizations like the New York Times, the Associated Press, beginning to not just have a presence on Facebook, but hiring social media editors to take charge of their social media efforts. There were courses being offered, social media skills for journalists, so it was kind of the zeitgeist in this 2009, 2010, 2011 period where Facebook was having a news kind of revolution. But I think what makes Facebook interesting is, again, the fact that it's been around for such a long time, that it changes up its interface quite regularly. But what makes it difficult to study is, as we've talked about before, not everybody's on Facebook. Some young people have left that platform for Instagram, even though Instagram is part of the same company, or the new TikTok, which is kind of my new fascinating foray in social media. So for me, I've always just been interested in the connection between technology and political engagement. You know, I came of age in the 90s, and when I went to college, all of a sudden we had the internet, we had email, and it was a lot of fun, silly stuff, like way back when the internet started. But then I also noticed, like, well, I was getting my news there. You know, I was able to find information. And because I kind of came of age in that era, I just have become very fascinated by the link, the interconnectedness between what we do online what we experience online and how that might translate offline.
I'm interested because obviously Facebook, having been around maybe the one of the longest of any of the social media platforms, I mean, it has a lot more to look at, particularly when you look at how it's evolved from being more socially oriented, the social part of social media, more to having this kind of big role in disseminating news and information, especially about politics. And I'm curious, has it followed a path similar to other social media or online engagement trends, or is it kind of its own thing in the way it's evolved?
I feel that it's kind of its own thing in the way that it has evolved. A lot of other platforms have been sort of user-driven. Twitter's a great example. Twitter was created as a short messaging service for people to communicate inter-office and otherwise, just to send very quick messages that would be very little data to go across a network. What people ended up doing with Twitter was very different. I don't know if you remember this. It was very funny to think about, but in the first few years where Twitter was kind of getting popular, people were summarizing novels in 180 characters. They were creating recipes in 180 characters, or 140, now it's 280. But people will use technology for things that it wasn't necessarily meant to be used for. That's one of the most fascinating things when I think about the relationship between technology and politics, is that we have these engineers creating software, creating platforms that they don't necessarily think about on the other end, ethically or morally, what are people going to do with this product or what we produce here? So I think where Facebook differs is that Twitter and TikTok have been largely, the content is largely generated by the users thing. Mm-hmm. And I think with Facebook, a lot of the components of the platform, a lot of the characteristics of it tend to be more top-down driven. In terms of how you, what you see, what comes up first, how it's organized, the algorithm that presents information to you when you refresh your newsfeed, for example. Whereas with something like Twitter, that's a much more self-stylized environment. It's depending on who you follow, what kind of network you have created. So I do think that Facebook's different in that way, and I think also because of the fact that they don't disclose a lot of their internal research about who uses Facebook for what and how often. There's a lot we don't know.
And I was going to say, I mean, so, you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about the algorithms and all that other stuff in a couple of minutes. But I do want to ask, you mentioned it seems kind of more top down in terms of what kind of drives its evolution. How much does the demographics play a role in this? I mean, we commonly hear, you know, that the kids aren't on Facebook anymore. So it's more parents, it's more older people. Is that a factor that might have driven it more from the social realm to the news and political realm?
Well, this is a great question, and I'm not sure it's something I can definitively answer because I think it's changing.
Okay.
I think particularly since the election of Donald Trump, we've seen a very large group of people online engaging in conservative media use, using platforms like Reddit and other lesser-known platforms to communicate about politics, where we maybe didn't see that necessarily before. So I think the demographics are kind of constantly changing. I think that, honestly, as we begin to live our lives more and more online, and a pandemic is a great real-world scenario to see what that looks like, we begin to see that our actions online and offline become somewhat seamless. So we're going to see demographics that are going to look similar online and offline in terms of people using news.
Is the kind of the move of Facebook more toward, you know, kind of news, information, politics, and maybe less the social aspect that it kind of was created to do? Is that driven a bit by the demographics? It seems to be an older demographic. So maybe while they're interested in the social interaction with friends and family, that they're also perhaps more inclined than a younger audience to want to also be talking about and sharing news, information, politics.
Sure. I think that's a traditional way of thinking about how different generations interact with news. I think that particularly given what we've seen in the recent Trump rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, it appears that there's a very large group of young people, teenagers specifically, who were engaging with news content to influence that particular rally. I think there's still not enough evidence to say exactly what happened.
Right.
But we do know that teenagers were actively involved on TikTok, which is not a political platform by any stretch,
mm-hmm.
until this incident, where supposedly these teenagers reserved all these seats for the rally and then obviously didn't go. There's something called incidental exposure. So, for example, before I studied technology, I was very interested in studying political satire and how people use political satire to engage with politics and whether it drives people to or away from engaging in politics. There's an argument for a while that political satire, like The Daily Show, was making people cynical and making them check out. And one of the studies I did with a colleague, Dana Young, and some other of my colleagues, found that the opposite was actually the case, that watching late-night programming made people feel more confident that they could do something, that they could vote, that they could change the system. And that efficacy then led to increased participation in the offline world. So incidental exposure to news in a platform where you maybe didn't go there for news is really, really important. And so what we're seeing is news being infiltrated into all these different social media platforms, even if we haven't necessarily opted into that. Now, in terms of Facebook in particular, they have over the years taken several different approaches to promoting news. For a while, they wanted to seem like more of a news platform, and people kind of weren't really into that, so they've backed away from that. But I would say that, you know, the more and more we get into this kind of seamless offline, online world, I think that the demographics are going to be similar. And what I can say in terms of young people, you know, teaching them at the college level, I've noticed a huge shift since 2016 in terms of the number of students who are interested in politics. And this is on what has been described as a relatively politically apathetic campus at the University of Delaware. But they are really engaged. And our student voter rate increased, I think it was 27% from midterms of 2014 to 2018. So I think that it's not necessarily just that demographics explain things in the same way over time. I think that we have to look at things, these periods. What I love about presidential elections is it's like a four-year experiment. Every 4 years, we get an experiment as to what is going on in this country, what I study in particular. I think what we're seeing is that young people are using these media differently. The TikTok example is a great one. But older people are obviously also engaging with it as well. So I think Facebook has actually stepped back from the news segment a little bit because I think they had a bit of a backlash. To me, what's most fascinating is seeing politics emerge on TikTok. I thought that was the last place I would ever see it.
Well, one of the things you mentioned earlier was, you know, kind of that Facebook, you know, does look at this stuff and study this stuff and research this stuff, but we don't necessarily get to see a lot of what Facebook knows. So having said that, what do we know about, you know, where information on Facebook is coming from, who's posting it, why, you know, anything that could illuminate what we're seeing when we're on Facebook?
So the big brands with lots of followers are, you know, going to be seen by more people. But the Facebook algorithm, the most important part about it is that Facebook algorithm is how Facebook decides what users see and in what order every time they check their news feed. So I don't know about you, but I find myself, if I'm bored, I have Facebook open on my phone, I might hit refresh, and all of a sudden a new list of items pops up. Mm-hmm. Well, that new list of items isn't simply chosen randomly. It's using survey data, using opinions from users, it's basically the method by which they explain how you see what you see. So they prioritize content that is based on the amount of time that users spend with that type of content. So if you are using more news, you may end up seeing more news. Mm-hmm. We didn't always have it until 2007 that we had sort of a like button. Once you could start interacting with, and now, of course, we have like, love, care is the newest Facebook emotion that you can display. Those are all bits of data that Facebook can look at as a whole and make decisions about what's keeping people on the site the longest. Because remember, all media, unless they're not for profit, are there to make money. So the more time your eyeballs are looking at that screen and seeing ads, the more money Facebook gets. So everything that this algorithm is created to do, and again, I don't know how it works, it's very secretive, they take that into account and try to make sure that you stay there as long as you can. They also prioritize the posts that receive comments, so people who have a lot of comments on their post. But they modify this all the time. But at the bottom line is it's looking at who a user typically interacts with, the type of media in the post, whether it's a video or a link, and then the popularity of that post. And that basically designates how that post is going to be ranked in your newsfeed.
And having said that, that I would assume has some kind of implications for people's political engagement on Facebook, that certain things kind of rise to the top, and it may color what you're seeing and therefore maybe what your perception of things are.
Absolutely. And so what we're seeing is people are kind of delving further and further into their own echo chambers on social media, and it's very easy to unfollow someone on Facebook. So you might feel like, oh, this would be kind of rude if I just didn't make them a friend anymore. Well, you know what? They don't know. You can just unfollow them. And while it may seem counterintuitive, because liberals typically have a larger media diet, a more diverse media diet than conservatives, who are typically relying a lot on Fox News, less on other sources. It's actually kind of counterintuitive, but liberals are more likely to unfriend or unfollow people who share a different political view than conservatives. So it's nobody's. We are creating sort of our own little echo chambers where we're unlikely to see comments from the other side. And what happened in 2016 that we're certainly going to see again is the prevalence of fake ads and fake information spreading that some people are going to see more likely than others. Very specifically, there was a targeted ad campaign that showed, "Do you want to vote for Hillary Clinton? Text blah, blah, blah to this number to vote for Hillary Clinton." Well, of course, we all know that you can't text to vote. but either way, this was an ad that was targeted specifically towards African Americans. And it just demonstrates that there are a lot of ways to manipulate these media that the companies themselves, I honestly believe, are not prepared for, and that they're acting, in many cases, retroactively rather than encountering this issue before it actually occurs.
Which brings me to the question of oversight. I mean, what do you see as the proper role of a Facebook in overseeing the contents that are on its platform? And you know, how have they kind of handled some of these controversies that it has faced to date? Because they have faced a number of them.
Absolutely. Well, and particularly regarding the president. We've never had a president before who was engaged in social media in the way that Donald Trump is. In fact, it was only about a year before he was elected that that Obama got on Twitter. And he used Twitter as sort of an amplification of other communications, whereas Donald Trump is using it to announce things, to say things for the first time rather than to amplify or reinforce. Suffice it to say, there have been several instances where people have called upon Twitter, have called upon Facebook to say, hey, what are you going to do about this post by the president of the United States? Because you have called this post inappropriate. You have removed people like Milo Yiannopoulos from this platform for saying sexist and offensive things. Why not this account? So what's happened is that Twitter has, for the first time, kind of taken a more of a stand against the president, or at least the president's content, than Facebook. So Facebook has been very much like, we just have the platform. You guys can say what you want, free speech, for the most part, unless it's dangerous. So Twitter has come out and labeled some content as misleading, such as a video that showed two little boys, a black boy and a white boy, running down the street, and labeling it as somehow racist. But it was a very misleading clip from an ad that was placed on with a CNN logo. Mm-hmm. So everything about it was very misleading. And Twitter called that out and put a sort of a warning label there. But here's the thing to keep in mind when it comes to these platforms in terms of officiating content. Yes, we in the United States have a First Amendment right to free speech. But these platforms are not a public square. They're not a public forum that's available to everyone. They are services that people can choose to download if they want. And their content isn't necessarily managed by the First Amendment. So these companies need to identify what are the rules of conduct? What are the values that we have that we're going to say, this is inconsistent with our values as a company? So I feel that it's the platform's duty to identify what those values are and adhere by those rules. It's not a free-for-all. You know, this is their platform. If people don't like that content there, they can go to a different place to post content that will allow them to do that. But Twitter and Facebook, being some of the most popular platforms there are, they need to do a better job.
Right.
You know, it's not until we address these things on the front end and until technology providers are not largely white men living in Silicon Valley and who are looking to philosophers, social scientists, and thinking about these things beforehand, as long as we don't have that, they're always going to be retroactively, oh, label this as false, label this as, you know, misleading, but it's still there, you know, like,
right.
it's kind of baffling to me that they don't have more responsibility over their content, that they don't take more, I guess,
ownership?
Yeah, ownership. I think that's a good word. It takes some ownership. This is your platform.
So, I mean, having discussed all this, I mean, in your opinion, you know, what are the benefits versus the risks of using Facebook as a news source?
In general, Facebook is not a good way to get your news because of the algorithm, because you are already likely in an echo chamber with people who share your similar beliefs. Twitter, largely the same, although with Twitter, I feel like it's a lot easier to follow people from all different types. So Facebook, you're kind of following, for the most part, people that you know. On Twitter, you can engage with strangers. You can engage with people you don't know. You can engage with people who don't agree with you. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, the benefit of Twitter over Facebook, because I can choose to follow both very conservative opinion writers and liberal opinion writers, conservative politicians and liberal politicians. And you can begin to see how the dialogue doesn't often overlap when you start following both of those sources. And that just, I think that offers a richer understanding of what's happening in the world. We have all of these implicit biases in our brains. Psychology has put together a list of, there's thousands of things that we do that when we process information, we can't take in all of the information that we see all the time. When you're looking at Facebook, aren't looking at every single thing that's happening at the same time. So we use certain cues. We look to people that we trust. We look to information that's novel or interesting. We look to graphics. So what we have to acknowledge is that we are all processing information in a biased way. Do I mean politically biased? No, but I mean biased towards quickly processing information and making sense of it. So if we slow that process down a little bit and say, okay, am I reacting to this because I want it to be true? Or am I reacting to this because I want it to be false? Take a step back and observe this from a more scholarly perspective or a bird's eye view and say, why am I reacting to this way? Could it have something to do with my opinions about it? And maybe before commenting, before sharing, before hitting the like button or that care button, close the phone, close the laptop, step away for a little while, and go engage with your family that you're stuck with in this pandemic.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to those who helped make today's show possible, Sierra Fisher and Kyle Parks with Delaware Humanities, who helped produce the A Matter of Facts podcast, contributor Larry Nangengast, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green takes a break next week for the July 4th weekend. We'll next see you on July 10th for The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.